am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. From then-Senator John F. Kennedy, Profiles in Courage, continued his essay on Senator George Norris of Nebraska. Picking up where we left off, Senator Norris had the courage to almost single-handedly oppose Woodrow Wilson's proposed bill to arm American merchant ships before America's entry into World War I, opposing it by filibustering it, drawing the ire of Congress, the president, and his constituents back in Nebraska. We continue with Senator Norris's decision to go from Washington back to Nebraska to explain his position on the bill that he opposed. The senator, announcing an open meeting in Lincoln to explain his position, was largely ignored by the press as he journeyed homeward, attempting to get the Republican National Committee man to act as chairman of the meeting. He was warned by that worthy gentleman that it was not possible for this meeting to be held without trouble. I think the meeting will be broken up, or at least you will have such an unfriendly audience that it will be impossible for you to make any coherent speech. One of the few friends who called upon him urged him to cancel the meeting by pleading illness, telling Norris that he had made a very sad mistake in returning to Nebraska when feelings ran so high. Others predicted that agitators would be scattered throughout the audience to make presentation of his arguments impossible, and told the senator that torpedoing of three more American merchant ships since the filibuster had further intensified the anger of his constituents. Quote, "I cannot remember a day in my life," the senator wrote in his autobiography, "when I have suffered more from a lonely feeling of despondency. My friends led me to believe that the people of Nebraska were almost unanimously against me." Close quote. Unable to get a single friend or supporter to act as chairman, Senator Norris nevertheless was determined to go through with the meeting. "I myself hired the hall," he told a lonely reporter in his deserted hotel room, "and it is to be my meeting. I am asking no one to stand sponsor for me or for my acts, but I have nothing to apologize for and nothing to take back." Walking from his hotel to the city auditorium on a beautiful spring night, Senator Norris anxiously noted that more than 3,000 people, the concerned, the skeptical, and the curious, had filled the auditorium, with many standing in the aisles and outside in the street. Calm but trembling, Norris walked out on the stage before them and stood for a moment without speaking, a solitary figure in a baggy black suit and a little black string tie. "I had expected an unfriendly audience," he wrote, "and it was with some fear that I stepped forward. When I entered the rear of the auditorium and stepped out on the stage, there was a deathlike silence. There was not a single hand clap, but I had not expected applause, and I was delighted that I was not hissed." In his homely, quiet, and yet intense manner, Senator Norris began with a simple phrase, "I have come home to tell you the truth." Stating, immediately there was a burst of applause from all parts of the audience. "Never in my lifetime has applause done me the good that did. There was in the hearts of the common people a belief that underneath the deception and the misrepresentation, the political power and the influence, there was something artificial about the propaganda. There was no violence, there was no heckling, and a tremendous crowd cheered mightily as Norris lashed out at his critics. His dry, simple, but persistent language and the quiet intensity of his anger captivated his audience, as he insisted that their newspapers were not giving them the facts and that, despite warnings that he stay away until his role in the filibuster was forgotten, he wanted it to be remembered. More than half of the New York audience, which had hissed him, had been in evening dress. He sarcastically recalled, and he questioned how many of them were willing to fight or send their children, stating, "Of course, if poodle dogs could have been made into soldiers, that audience would have supplied a regiment. My colleague talked 2.5 hours for the bill and was called a hero. I talked 1.5 hours against the bill and was called a traitor. Even though you say I am wrong, even though you feel sure I should have stood by the president, has a time come when we can't even express our opinions in the Senate? When we were sent to debate such questions without being branded by the moneyed interests as traitors? I can stand and take my medicine without wincing under any charge except that of traitor. In all the English language, in all the tongues of the world, you can't find any other words as damnable as that. The crowd, after more than an hour, roared its approval. The newspapers were not so easily convinced or so willing to forgive. His elaborate and ingenious explanation, said the World Herald newspaper, is foolish nonsense, a silly statement which has disgusted the people. The senator spent little time meeting the issue as it actually stood, said the State Journal newspaper. He should not let his critics disturb his balance. But Senator Norris, who was asked to appear before many groups to explain what he felt to be the true issues, met acclaim throughout the state, and the governor, having announced that he would not ask the legislature to authorize a special recall election of Norris, the senator returned to Washington better able to withstand the abuse, which had not yet fully ceased. During the next 11 years, George Norris's fame and political fortune multiplied. In 1928, despite his continued differences with the Republican Party and its administrations, the Nebraska senator was one of the party's most prominent members, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and a potential presidential nominee. But Norris himself scoffed at the latter reports, stating, "I have no expectation of being nominated for president. A man who has followed the political course I have is barred from the office. I realize perfectly that no man holding the views I do is going to be nominated for the presidency." With an oath, he rejected the suggestion that he accept a position as Herbert Hoover's running mate, and he attacked the Republican Convention's platform and the methods by which it had selected its nominees. In those years, prior to the establishment of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the senator from Nebraska was the nation's most outspoken advocate of public power, and he believed that the monolithic power trust had dictated the nomination of Hoover and the Republican platform. Unwilling to commit himself to the Democratic Party he had always opposed, and whose platform he believed to be equally weak, Norris toured the country campaigning for fellow progressives regardless of party. But as the campaign utterances of Democratic nominee Al Smith in New York began to fall into line with Norris's own views, he was confronted with the most difficult political problem of his career. George Norris was a Republican, a Midwesterner, a Protestant, and a dry. And Herbert Hoover was all of those things. But Al Smith, a Tammany Hall Democrat from the streets of New York, and a Catholic who favored the repeal of Prohibition, was none of them. Surely Smith could have little support in Nebraska, which was also Republican, Midwestern, Protestant, and dry by nature. Could Senator Norris possibly desert his party, his state, and his constituents under such circumstances? He could. He had always maintained that he would like to abolish party responsibility and in its stead establish personal responsibility. Any man, even though he be the strictest kind of Republican, who does not believe the things I stand for are right, should follow his convictions and vote against me. And thus, in 1928, Norris finally declared that progressives had no place to land except in the Al Smith camp. Shall we be so partisan that we will place our party above our country and refuse to follow the only leader who affords us any escape from the control of the power trust? It seems to me that we cannot crush our consciences and support somebody who we know in advance is opposed to the very things for which we have been fighting so many years. But what about Smith's religious views? What about his attitude on the liquor question? Norris stated, "It is possible for a man in public life to separate his religious beliefs from his political activities. I am a Protestant and a dry, yet I would support a man who was a wet and a Catholic, provided I believed he was sincerely in favor of law enforcement and was right on economic issues. I would rather trust an honest wet who is progressive and courageous in his makeup than politicians who profess to be on the dry side but do no more to make prohibition effective than all the rum runners and bootleggers in the country. These were courageous sentiments, but they were lost on an indignant constituency. As his train sped through the state on the way to Omaha, where he was to speak for Al Smith over a nationwide radio hookup, longtime friends and Republican leaders climbed aboard to appeal in the name of his party and career. The head of the powerful Nebraska Anti-Saloon League, previously an important supporter of Senator Norris, termed his injection of the power issue poppycock, stating, "The issue in this campaign is the liquor issue, and Norris knows it. If he makes his speech for Smith, the league is through with him." Norris, when asked if he would run for re-election in 1930 in view of such statements, dryly replied that such things might drive me to it. The pastor of the largest Baptist church in Omaha wrote the senator that he did not represent us at all, and we are very much ashamed of your attitude toward the administration. But Norris, in his reply, calmly asked the minister whether he had made any attempt to take the beam out of your own eyes so that you can see more clearly how to pluck the mote out of your brother's eye. Old Guard Republican leaders had previously insisted, at least privately, that Senator Norris was no Republican, a charge they now made openly. But now many of Norris's most devoted followers expressed dismay at his bolt. Said an Eagle, Nebraska small businessman, quote, "I have supported Norris for 20 years, but never again. He is politically warped and mentally a grouch, and has antagonized every Republican administration since Roosevelt. The senator should have more respect for his admirers than to expect them to cast their lot with a wet Democrat," close quote. Norris's first congressional secretary told reporters he was bitterly opposed to the senator's unwarranted support of Tammany's candidate for president, Al Smith. A delegate who had supported Norris for president at the Republican convention told the press that Norris does not carry my political conscience in his vest pocket. I am deeply grieved to see the stand he has taken. Norris should seek new friends, and if he chooses to find them on the sidewalks of New York, that is his privilege. But it is unfortunate that he uses the Republican Party as a vehicle to ride into office and then repudiates its standard bearer. The editor of the Watt Hill Times newspaper wrote, "I say it sadly, but I am through with Norris. Politically, he is lost in the wilderness, far away from his old progressive friends. For a hungry farmer or a thirsty wet of less than average political judgment," said a Lincoln attorney who was close to the Norris camp, "there may be an excuse. But for a statesman of Norris's ability and experience, there is no excuse." But George Norris sought to help the hungry farmer, even if it meant helping the thirsty wet. Unmoved by either appeals or attacks, he delivered a powerful plea for Al Smith at Omaha, Nebraska. The New York governor, he said, had risen above the dictates of Tammany Hall. While the techniques employed by the Republican convention would make Tammany Hall appear as a white-robed saint. He was traveling in very distinguished company by supporting the candidate of the opposing party, he told his audience, for Herbert Hoover himself had acted similarly 10 years earlier. But for the most part, his speech was an attack upon the power trust, an octopus with slimy fingers that levies tribute upon every fireside, and upon Hoover's refusal to discuss these questions, to sin by silence when we should protest, makes cowards out of men. Finally, Norris closed his address by meeting the religious issue openly, stating, "It is our duty as patriots to cast out this un-American doctrine and rebuke those who have raised the torch of intolerance. All believers of any faith can unite and go forward in our political work to bring about the maximum amount of happiness for our people. But in 1928, the people of Nebraska were not willing to listen to the theme of tolerance or a discussion of the issues. Telegrams poured in attacking Norris for his support of a Catholic and a wet. The storm which followed that Omaha pronouncement for Smith, Norris later recalled, was more violent than any I had ever encountered. It was well that I had some training in the matter of abuse. Even his wife was quoted by the papers as saying she would vote for neither Smith nor Hoover. I am not following George in all this. I have always been a dry, and I am not going to vote for Al Smith even if George does. Although the same powerful Democratic newspaper, the Omaha World Herald, which had assailed his stand for principle against Woodrow Wilson in 1917, was now able to applaud Senator Norris for his splendid courage and devotion. Other Nebraska newspapers accused him of deserting his state for Tammany Hall in the hopes of reviving his own presidential boom 4 years later. His speech had endangered the chances for re-election of his own liberal Republican colleague, and his fellow insurgent Republicans in the Senate expressed their disapproval of his course. When the senator returned to his hometown, he found his friends and other leading citizens running away, as though they would be glad to cut my heart out and hang it on a fence as a warning to others. The landslide for Hoover in the election, who carried practically every county and community in Nebraska, as well as the country as a whole, embittered Norris, who declared that Hoover had won on the false question of religion and prohibition when the real problems were power and farm relief. The special interests of machine politicians, he said, kept this issue to the front, although they knew it was a false, wicked, and unfair issue. George Norris's filibuster against the arms ship bill in 1917 had failed, both in its immediate goal of preventing the president's action and in its attempt to keep the nation out of the war into which it was plunged a few months later. Norris's campaign for Al Smith also failed, and failed dismally. And yet, as the senator confided to a friend in later years, stating, "It happens very often that one tries to do something and fails. He feels discouraged, and yet he may discover years afterward that the very effort he made was the reason why somebody else took it up and succeeded. I really believe that whatever use I have been to progressive civilization has been accomplished in the things I failed to do, rather than in the things I actually did do." George Morris met with both success and failure in his long tenure in public office, stretching over nearly a half a century of American political life. But the essence of the man and his career was caught in a tribute paid to the Republican senator from Nebraska by the Democratic presidential nominee in September 1932, Franklin D. Roosevelt. History asks, did the man have integrity? Did the man have unselfishness? Did the man have courage? Did the man have consistency? There are few statesmen in America today who so definitely and clearly measure up to an affirmative answer to those four questions, as does George W. Norris. This concludes John F. Kennedy's essay on George W. Norris, and we now turn to John F. Kennedy's essay on Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio, Liberty of the Individual to Think His Own Thoughts. The late Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio was never President of the United States. Therein lies his personal tragedy, and therein lies his national greatness. For the presidency was a goal that Bob Taft pursued throughout his career in the Senate, an ambition that this son of a former president has always dreamed of realizing. As the leading exponent of the Republican philosophy for more than a decade, Mr. Republican, as he was known, was bitterly disappointed by his failure on three different occasions even to receive the nomination. But Robert A. Taft was also a man who stuck fast to the basic principles in which he believed. And when those fundamental principles were at issue, not even the lure of the White House or the possibilities of injuring his candidacy could deter him from speaking out. He was an able politician, but on more than one occasion he chose to spoke out in defense of a position no politician with like ambitions would have endorsed. He was moreover a brilliant political analyst who knew that during his lifetime, the number of American voters who agreed with the fundamental tenets of his political philosophy was destined to be a permanent minority, and that only by flattering new blocks of support while carefully refraining from alienating any group which contained potential Taft voters could he ever hope to attain his goal. Yet he frequently flung to the winds the very restraints his own analysis advised, refusing to bow to any group, refusing to keep silent on any issue. It is not that Bob Taft's career in the Senate was a constant battle between popularity and principle, as was John Quincy Adams. He did not have to struggle to maintain his integrity like Thomas Hart Benton. His principles usually led him to conclusions which a substantial percentage of his constituents and political associates were willing to support. Although on occasions his political conduct reflected his political ambitions, popularity was not his guide on most fundamental matters. The Taft-Hartley Labor Management Relations Act could not have gained him many votes in industrialized Ohio, for those who endorsed its curbs on union activity were already Taft supporters. But it brought furious anti-Taft reprisals during the 1950 Senate campaign by the unions in Ohio, and it nourished the belief that Taft could not win a presidential contest, a belief which affected his chances for the nomination in 1952. Simultaneously, however, he was antagonizing the friends of Taft-Hartley and endangering his own leadership in the Republican Party by his support of education, housing, health, and other welfare measures. Those who were shocked at these apparent departures from his traditional position did not comprehend that Taft's conservatism contained a strong strain of pragmatism, which caused him to support intensive federal activity in those areas that he believed not adequately served by the private enterprise system. Taft did not believe that this was inconsistent with the conservative doctrine. Conservatism, in his opinion, was not irresponsibility. Thus, he gave new dimensions to the conservative philosophy. He stuck to that faith when it reached its lowest depth of prestige and power and led it back to the level of responsibility and respectability. He was an unusual leader, for he lacked the fine arts of oratory and phrase-making. He lacked blind devotion to the party line, unless he dictated it, and he lacked the politician's natural instinct to avoid controversial positions and issues. But Taft was more than a political leader, more than Mr. Republican. He was also a Taft, and thus Mr. Integrity. The senator's grandfather, Alfonso Taft, had moved west to practice law in 1830, writing his father that the notorious selfishness and dishonesty of the great mass of men you find in New York is to my mind a serious obstacle to settling there. And the senator's father was William Howard Taft, who knew well the meaning of political courage and political abuse when he stood by his Secretary of Interior, Ballinger, against the overwhelming opposition of Pinchot, Roosevelt, and the progressive elements of his own party. So Bob Taft, as his biographer had described it, was born to integrity. He was known in the Senate as a man who never broke an agreement, who never compromised his deeply felt Republican principles, who never practiced political deception. His bitter political enemy, Harry Truman, would say when the senator died, "He and I did not agree on public policy, but he knew where I stood, and I knew where he stood." We need intellectually honest men like Senator Taft. Examples of his candor are endless and startling. The Ohioan once told a group in the heart of Republican farm territory that farm prices were too high, and he told still another farm group that he was tired of seeing all these people riding in Cadillacs. His support of an extensive federal housing program caused a colleague to remark, I hear the socialists have gotten to Bob Taft. He informed an important political associate who cherished a commendatory message signed by Taft that his assistants sent those things out by the dozen without the senator even seeing, much less signing them. And a colleague recalls that he did not reject the ideas of his friends by gentle indirection, but by coldly and unhesitantly terming them nonsense. He had, as William S. White had written, a luminous candor of purpose that was extraordinarily refreshing in a chamber not altogether devoted to candor. It would be a mistake, however, to conclude from this that Senator Taft was cold and abrupt in his personal relationships. I recall from my own very brief service with him in the Senate and on the Senate Labor Committee in the last months of his life, my strong impression of a surprising and unusual personal charm and a disarming simplicity of manner. It was these qualities, combined with an unflinching courage, which he exhibited throughout his entire life, and most especially in his last days, that bound his adherence to him with unbreakable ties. Perhaps we are not as yet too close in time to the controversial elements in the career of Senator Taft to be able to measure his life with historical perspective. A man who can inspire intensely bitter enemies, as well as intensely devoted followers, is best judged after many years pass, enough years to permit the settlement of political and legislative battles to settle, so that we can assess our times more clearly. Reader's note, John F. Kennedy wrote these words not too long after Senator Taft passed away. This ends for today the reading on Senator Bob Taft, which will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona,